Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Porque tiene espacio Martin Odegaard. Juega con Gabriel Jesús. El control es bueno. Aguanta Gabriel Jesús. Encara a Cook. Quiere romper el brasileño. Aguanta bien Cook. Filtra para Declan Rice. Declan Rice en el área. Declan Rice acaba de firmar y acaba de poner del todo su sello en el partido. El gol de Declan Rice. Saluda al público. Rice.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always. James from Gunner Blog. James, a very goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a bank holiday here in Ireland. We had a beautiful day of sunshine yesterday. I watched some of the football and got a bit depressed about that. But hey, that's, you know, par for the course. I guess that's par for the course if you're routinely watching Spurs, which, you know, I don't do very often, as you know.
Listen, I managed to find some enjoyment in the Spurs game. I laugh about the days when I naively believed that might be Manchester City's hardest remaining fixture. Yeah, it's all changed on that front.
Were those the days when you were high as a kite on illegal narcotics?
Very possibly. I also made the mistake. I obviously was at the Arsenal game and terrific start to the weekend, had a brilliant time. And, you know, I thought, I'm not going to watch Man City. And then I got home and it was around the time of kickoff. And I thought, oh, go on then. I'll stick it on. Oh. I stuck on Man City versus Wolves. I can't remember how long it was into the game. Not very long. They got given a very soft penalty. Erling Haaland tucks it away, and I promptly turned it off, got on with my day at that point in time.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. I mean, I did the opposite in that, you know, the Arsenal game was on, was doing the post-game stuff, and then was like, you know what? I don't even want to consider what Manchester City are going to do in this game. So I decided to go out and have a couple of beers and get some food, you know, in the vain hope that at some point, while sitting there having a couple of pints, my phone would just start going zzz, 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 zzz. And I'd look and there'd be like 15 WhatsApps from various people going, Wolves, oh my God, Wolves. Well, you know, none of those texts
even
ever arrived.
3-0 down, 3-0 down, whang. Got one back, 3-1. And there were sort of ironic messages from a couple of people being like, here we go. And then I think Erling Haaland smashed one in about 30 seconds later just to extinguish the slimmest hopes. So there you go. But Arsenal did their part very, very well.
They certainly did.
So at least we could enjoy that.
We could. Nice sunny day at the Emirates. Unchanged side from Mikel Arteta. And, you know, I saw quite a few people talking about this game beforehand, thinking, ooh, you know, the Bournemouth are good. There was the, you know, the stat going around that only the top four have taken more points in the Premier League since October than Bournemouth. You know, they've really settled into life under Andoni Iraola. They play well. They've got some decent players. You know, was this a potential banana skin fixture? You know, it feels feels a bit like this sort of second to last home game of the season hasn't always gone well. Like last season, wasn't it like Brighton 3-0, something like that? That wasn't great. So was it possible that Arsenal could be found out? Would the pressure get to us? Sorry, I'm after knocking something over here. Anyway, not to worry.
the pressure's got to me.
I'm ruining my office all around me. But in terms of the overall performance, there's no question that the pressure didn't get to Arsenal. But, you know, there were a lot of chances or a lot of shots. There were a lot of the ball not going in the back of the net, to the point where, you know, there was a point in the first half where I was thinking, uh-oh, this feels like it could be one of those days.
It did have that feel to it.
Yeah.
I think if you sort of analyse the game with a step back, there are similarities between this match and the Aston Villa one, which we lost, in that we were completely dominant in the first half. And spent a lot of that first half conspiring to not score a goal. And they were much improved after the break. But, you know, we did get those killer moments in the box to get the scoreline that we needed. And, you know, when they had one or two moments in our box, things generally went in our favour. So a very good win nonetheless against a good Bournemouth side. In the week leading up to it, I got a bit nervous because everyone I spoke to was telling me how good Bournemouth are. I convinced myself they were sort of going to turn up and be like the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, the greatest ever Real Madrid side or something.
Yeah.
So very, very satisfied to get the win, and especially by such a handsome scoreline, which keeps our goal difference looking pretty healthy, whatever City do.
Yes, I did look at that City scoreline and think, oh God, they've taken a chunk out of our goal difference there. But also, I sort of didn't take into account the fact that we won 3-0. So I felt a little bit better. That was the only slight comfort I had from the Man City win. But, you know, the way we played in that first half, I think, was... Mikel Arteta called it maybe, did he say it was the best we've played all season or the best half we played all season? You know, it was dominant and certainly we had the chances, but it was also, I think, a good example of what this team is about and how they can cause the opposition problems, because you can be quite sure that the Bournemouth game plan would have been to try and stifle Arsenal from the start, maybe play on the fact that we're, you know, there's a lot at stake for us, so we could have had some nerves. But, you know, I think it was maybe 2 minutes in, and Ben White just threw the ball down the line to, could have been Odegaard, who was in behind, and you're thinking, okay, we're going to get some success out of this Bournemouth team because they're not quite where they should be in terms of organization. And there were chances, weren't there, within the first 10 minutes or so, Saka had a shot blocked and Trossard had a shot blocked. And, you know, it really did set the tone for what we were going to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the first 20 minutes, the game could have been won, actually. You know, Arsenal were that dominant and had some pretty promising openings. You know, I think there's not a lot to criticise about this Arsenal team at this point in time. They are playing terrific football and doing extremely well. I think if Mikel Arteta will always be looking for areas of improvement, and I think maybe one is in these dominant spells, you know, maybe sometimes they just need to show a little bit more composure or a little bit more cutting edge to decide games when they're so on top as they were in that first 20 minutes. But yeah, Bournemouth couldn't live with us. I mean, that throw in's a great example. If you don't know Arsenal are going to try that throw down the line to someone who's in an offside position but not offside, then you're in trouble, because that's, you know, a pretty frequent part of what we do in the opposition at half. So, yeah, there was a sign there that we might be able to get at them.
Yes, and I think you have to give Bournemouth some credit, actually, in the first half, because particularly the first part of that first half, because of how well they defended. They got men in front of the ball. They blocked shots. The keeper made a couple of good saves. Like, I think for all the dominance, there wasn't, you know, a moment until maybe a bit later in the half where you thought, oh, we've made a balls of that one. We should have done better with that, because, you know, they did defend stoutly. They did get men in the way. There was some last-ditch defending. I think Senesi, there was one really good block. Mm-hmm. Mark Travers in goal made a couple of good saves, I think,
played
as well.
Yeah.
He was quite decisive at times. There were good saves from him. But there was a moment, I guess, 10, 11 minutes into the game, that we'll have people talking. Ryan Christie with a tackle, a challenge, maybe you could better put it, on Bukayo Saka, which, you know, I think could easily have been a red card.
Can you just fill me in? Did he even blow up for a foul, the referee?
I can't remember now, to be honest. I'll have to just go back and look at that passage of play again, because, you know, it's the third time in recent weeks that a challenge on an Arsenal player could easily have resulted. No, he didn't. I'm just watching it here. Bang, in comes Christie, over the ball. I'm not sure the ref... I think he wanted to play Arsenal an advantage.
Right.
Which is
the ball, it breaks for Declan Rice.
Martin Odegaard, I think.
Okay.
Saka's down. He's banging the turf. There's a Bournemouth player down as well. I don't know why. Is it... Maybe he got a bang in the head. I don't really care about the Bournemouth player, though.
What I find strange is that... It feels to me like when refs play advantage in a situation like that, they almost never come back and give it the proper attention it deserves. So just because you play advantage, to my mind, does not mean that you shouldn't be issuing a card. And for me, the most staggering aspect of this was that he didn't issue any card at all.
Yes.
You know, I think you can debate if it's a yellow or a red, but to get away without a card in that instance... Especially for a player who was eventually booked in the second half, you know, it's particularly galling that he didn't receive anything.
Well, I mean, is that a red for you? It's not, to me, it's not, I mean, it's not a, I don't think it's as bad as the Kilman on Havertz one. I don't think it's as bad as the Jackson on Tomiyasu one.
No.
But it's very similar to what Fabio Vieira got sent off for. And when you look at the damage it actually did to Bukayo Saka, you know, I don't know why that's not taken into account. I think you're right. He should at the very least have gone back and booked Yates for that challenge. I also think it demonstrates an absurdity in the VAR system that they keep, you know, we know they can't tell the ref that should be a yellow card. Like if it's not a red, it should definitely be a yellow. But VAR can't tell the referee that that should be a yellow card. And I think that's ridiculous. I do think that is a ridiculous aspect of VAR, because VAR has, play has stopped, VAR has checked. They could easily tell the referee, go and have another look at that. He goes and has a look. Is it red? No, I don't think it's quite red, but that should be a yellow card. You cannot, you know, at the very least, you cannot make a challenge like that and get away with no booking whatsoever. And I think what's kind of crazy is the fact that those three challenges, you know, the one on Saka, the one on Tomiyasu, the one on Havertz, in those games have resulted in a grand total of one yellow card. That's just absurd to me.
Yeah, well, it is. And... it's a very odd one. I agree with you. This tackle, or this challenge, we should probably say, is not quite as bad. I think maybe because the ball is so high, there's a bit of mitigation as to why the feet are high. You know, it's not like the ball's on the ground and he's gone in over it. I think that there's a sort of interesting conversation to be had generally about the implementation of VAR after this game and after this weekend. I mean, it might not be particularly novel or particularly new, but you know, this game, as several others were this weekend, was characterised by quite long delays that ultimately resulted in going with the on-field decision. And it feels like we've sort of got the worst of both worlds in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, I understand wanting to give the on-field decision some precedence or make sure those referees have authority, you know, only overturn if it's a clear and obvious error. But I'd say if you're having to spend 2 or 3 minutes looking at it, and we'll get to other incidents later in the game where that was the case, then it almost certainly isn't a clear and obvious error. And you probably need to move on quicker for the sake of the game. So I found VAR quite exasperating in this game. As for the yellow card thing, I agree. They should be able to say, look, you need to book him for that. Because him not, Christie not being booked for that challenge is absolutely a clear and obvious error.
No, it surely is. And about 3 minutes later, Christie puts in another challenge on Kai Havertz, which again goes unpunished by the referee. I think that challenge is a yellow card too. So if he didn't get a red in that first instance, he might he would have got away with it, I guess. But maybe the fact that he was on a yellow card might have raised something from the crowd. The crowd then would have reacted to that challenge a little more vigorously. So I think, you know, between not getting a straight red and also not getting two yellows in the space of 5 minutes, Ryan Christie was very, very lucky in that first half for Bournemouth. And I know they will have their complaints about certain elements of this game, but, you know, you can always look at, you know, what goes on and say, okay, you're a bit unlucky there. However, you're also a bit fortunate to have 10 men on the pitch.
And he was booked later in the game, Christie. So, you know,
eventually.
The likelihood is he wouldn't have survived the 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And also, if the ref had flashed up a red card immediately after that Christie challenge, I don't think VAR would have overturned it. Mm. That's for sure.
I don't think so either.
Which again, I mean, you know, to be fair, illustrates that it is a kind of subjective decision. I think almost whatever he gave, I could see that probably they wouldn't overturn it. But I just found not booking him to be inexplicable.
Yes, but there you go. There's a lot of that going on with officials and decision making these days. We don't want to get too hung up on that. I think what we need to look at is what we did do for the rest of that second half. And there were moments where, you know, we've given Bournemouth credit for defending well, for making good saves. I also think we have to look at a couple of the chances that we had and say we didn't do quite as well as we should have with them. And the two I'm thinking of are one from Thomas Partey, where he just booted it over the bar. I know that's his, you know, trademark finish, but still, from 10 yards out, I was expecting him to do a bit better. And Declan Rice as well, I think it was a really good cross. Great head down from Kai Havertz, and he hit the ball on the bounce and just spun it wide of the near post, where you're kind of expecting someone like Declan Rice to be able to put that in the back of the net. Went maybe with the outside of the foot because of the way the ball was bouncing, when perhaps he could have gone with the inside of the foot. But, you know, those were two moments, I think, where had we gone in 0-0 at halftime, we'd be thinking, oh, gosh, you know, those were the two big chances of that first half.
Yeah, and listening to Declan Rice's post-match interview, I think it stayed with him. Maybe it propelled him into what he produced towards the end of the game, you know, sort of having that miss hanging over him. But they were great chances and two brilliant headers, actually. You know, Havertz for Rice, was it? And Tomiyasu, who sets up Thomas Partey with a brilliant header. You know, the ball's going the opposite direction. He manages to turn it back into Partey's path. Should have scored there. There was a little scare, by the way, at the other end. I don't know if you remember, but where I think Gabriel made an error and Saliba had to bail him out. So, you know, and Gabriel, I think, looked a little bit shakier in that first half than he has for most of the season. Mm-hmm. Just had one or two moments. But fortunately, his mate was there to help out when required.
Yeah, you mentioned Tomiyasu. We're probably not going to talk about him in any great detail, because there are other players who really stood out for Arsenal in this game. But I think he had a low-key, excellent game. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the chance he set up for Thomas Partey, but also he set up one for Kai Havertz with a lovely little clip ball from midfield over the top. Havertz had a shot at the near post, which the keeper saved. And I think defensively he was really good. I don't think any player won more aerial duels on the pitch than Tomiyasu the other day. So I think he had a really solid game, and ahead of a big game against Manchester United at the weekend, I think he did more than enough to keep his place at left back there. I don't think that's even going to be a debate beyond any kind of fitness issue. I think he's well set for that game. But we did go ahead via a penalty. Martin Odegaard with a really excellent pass. Kai Havertz took it on. The keeper came out. Kai Havertz went down. Referee pointed to the spot. There was a VAR check. Goes back to what you were saying about the the on-field decision. And I do think it is one of those where when you look at it and you look at what's happened over the course of the season, there was no reasonable expectation that they would overturn the on-field decision. But I was a little bit worried all the same, because, you know, it felt to me like well, they do change the way they do things. No, that's not a penalty anymore, even though it's been a penalty all season. It wouldn't have surprised me if that decision had been overturned. How did you view, you know, the check, and how did you view the incident itself?
I must say, I think it's a penalty. Right. I think it's a nailed-on penalty.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting.
Because I think Kai Havertz basically doesn't change his path. You know, he's running in a straight line. Keeper comes out and catches him.
Mm.
I think that's been a penalty, like you say, all season long.
Do you think Kai Havertz could stay on his feet there?
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I was a bit disappointed that he didn't, in that he's done the hard part. Like, he goes around the keeper, and I think Kai Havertz is a really good game, but I would like my centre-forward to stay on his feet and put that ball in the back of the net.
Mm.
And I think he's absolutely looking for it, but nonetheless, I think it is a penalty. What's your opinion?
I mean, I think it's a penalty as well. It's just one of those that down the years has always frustrated me when they're given against us, where goalkeeper comes. I mean, Havertz does have to get out of the way. He does leave his leg there to make sure the contact is given. Down, like, if I were to mention players like Harry Kane or Jamie Vardy, it's the kind of penalty they used to win against us. And on the one hand, you can say slightly clumsy from the goalkeeper / defender. On the other, the guy has gone down and initiated contact with the goalkeeper. So I'm kind of, you know, the way I view penalties, if it was given against us, would I be unhappy? Maybe slightly. But at this point,
he's committed though, Travis, hasn't he? He's gone big, like he's dived at the player's feet. He hasn't got any contact on the ball.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is a foul. Well, at least sort of the application of the laws as it stands. Like I say, I think that's been a penalty all season. I don't think it's quite the same as when a player chucks out their leg to make contact with a defender or
that's
a goalkeeper.
That's fair.
You know, Havertz, it is kind of, he stays in his lane, as it were, and Travers comes into it. The ones where, you know, someone runs past a player and then flings their leg out to the side so they get caught, I think that's slightly different.
It's sort of along the lines of one of those where a player goes beyond the goalkeeper. There's no real contact from the goalkeeper, but they fall down and make sure that they make contact with the goalkeeper. And you can say he's impeding him and he's obstructing him, so he's every right to go down. I think Havertz did have every right to go down in that situation. But like I said, it wouldn't have surprised me a huge amount if they'd looked at that and said, yeah, maybe not. But they looked at it for quite a while.
They did. And again, that sort of comes back to my point just about sort of the viewing experience. I think that a couple of replays of that, they should have been able to see, well, you know, this is not sufficient to overturn the on-field decision. I don't think it needed that degree of depth and study, but there you go. That's the way it is in the Premier League at the present point in time. They're sort of happy to pause the game for quite protracted periods and then ultimately stick with the on-field, which is really frustrating. But yeah, I also think that these calls, I mean, we're talking about the red card, we're talking about the penalty, we've got another big one to come in the second half. You know, I think you could find lots of people on either side of the argument, and I think that does also illustrate the difficulty VAR has as trying to set a kind of objective bar in a sport where so many of the calls feel subjective.
Yes. Anyway, it was up to Bukayo Saka to take the penalty to put us 1-0 up. And he did so in a very cool way, didn't he? It was a really confident penalty from a player whose record from the spot this season, I think he's, what, 6 out of 6? Is that what it is?
Exemplary.
You know, is he changing your mind? Are you feeling better now when you see Bukayo Saka?
I am. I think it's 10 of 11 competitive penalties since the Euros. We all know what the 11th was, but we don't need to talk about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is a very good record by any standard. And he couldn't have looked more calm and composed tucking this away.
No.
To be honest, actually, he was a bit too calm and composed with that chance that came to him early in the second half. But in this instance, he got it spot on.
Yes, he did. And that was 1-0. I think that was a big goal in the context of this game and the context of the title race, you know, where we talked about it. Oh, is it going to be one of those days? Had we gone in 0-0, had we missed a penalty, it would have really felt like it was going to be one of those days, but no mistake from Bukayo Saka. 20 goals in all competitions now for him, so it's a lovely landmark for him to have achieved so far this season. You know, even though he hasn't really played very well, has he? You know,
no, can't wait till he finds form.
Yeah, it'd be good. And like you say, there was a really big chance for him early in the second half where Havertz did very, very well in the centre forward position, played it to him. I wondered, you know, did he think he had to take it first time because he had more time than he thought there? I think he could have taken a touch.
Yeah, perhaps so. It was really good stuff from Havertz, and he's got a lot of options there, Saka. He can take a touch, hit with his left. He can shift it onto his right. We know he can do that. He takes it early, but it's not the cleanest strike. And that, you know, it was interesting because after that, Bournemouth had a decent little spell, didn't they? So you kind of, well, I was worried that that might feel like a moment. But it didn't come to pass.
Yeah, they did have a chance. Was it Solanke?
Wasn't it? Yeah,
at the near post. I mean, there was a lot of complaining because in the build-up to that happening, Odegaard is taken out, like absolutely taken out in midfield. Not by the guy who has the ball, but taken out kind of off the ball as he's going to try and make a tackle. Raya didn't have a great deal to do, but he stood up well and made the save there. But Bournemouth were certainly more in it in the second half. They played higher up the pitch. They pressed a bit higher. There were a couple of bookings, I think, that we got. Havertz got booked for jumping. I don't know what that was about. It seems mad to me that Havertz can get booked. There was a really good tackle on Saka, wasn't there, in the box. Again, Havertz down the left played a good ball into the middle and Bournemouth defended pretty well. And it was more open. I'm not saying it was quite end-to-end, but as a game, it was certainly more open. We felt a bit more open, but maybe that's because Bournemouth had far more of the ball in this half than they did in the first.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first half it was something crazy, like 80% possession, wasn't it? So they adjusted, and I think they made a couple of tweaks and were a much better side as a consequence of it. So much so that our second goal, I think, arguably came a bit against the run of play, but the relief that it provided was huge. You know, Arsenal, we spoke about the first goal and the timing of that and us really needing it. You'd say the same for the second. It was a goal that suddenly made what felt like quite an awkward game a lot more straightforward.
Yeah. I mean, the way we worked this ball, Tomiyasu wins a really big header on the touchline, gets across very well, wins a header, Trossard gets it back, and then we work the ball across the pitch and up the pitch. It's a nice piece of play, and I'm sure people will have seen the analysis of where Declan Rice was at the start of the move. He was on the edge of our box, and I think it's Odegaard looking for Havertz. Pass doesn't quite come off, but Rice is there, takes a touch. It's not the best touch he'll ever have in his life, but the way he improvises and just sort of turns and plays a ball with the outside of his foot to Trossard is fantastic. I mean, it's really good. Is just split second realizing, you know, where he is, what he can do with the ball, and finding Trossard in the way that he does. Finish from Trossard, who, you know, I think he was okay in this game, but once again, he's popped up with a big goal at a big time in a big game.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, we spoke about Saka maybe taking the shot too early. I think taking the shot early for Trossard here works a treat because keeper's not quite set. It doesn't actually go right in the corner or anything, you know, but it's just a decent strike, low and hard. Keeper can't get down to it. He's got the nose for goal, Leandro Trossard, and another big contribution. And like I say, the timing of it was just so critical. It just gave us breathing space at a point in the game where we really needed it.
Absolutely. There were changes then from both sides, and then a big incident in our box where they had a goal disallowed.
And again, they stuck with the on-field, you know, which I do understand that, and I think that there's merit in that. But for me, we got away with one here. I think that this was a really soft decision from the referee. I don't think there's a lot in it. And when you break it down and watch it frame by frame, I think, you know, Bournemouth can feel a little bit aggrieved by that one.
Well,
personally.
Here's my thoughts on this.
Yes, go on.
I sort of agree with you, but what I think, I mean, the ref made his mind up quickly, right?
Yeah.
And what I think got us the decision in the end, because I agree, it's quite soft on Raya.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a huge amount of contact. There was a goal in the Chelsea-Spurs game the other night, remember? It was disallowed late on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was it that? Was it a Chelsea game? Or Chelsea Villa, maybe, actually.
Okay.
Where there was a nudge in the box and Chelsea scored and then it was disallowed for the nudge
in the
box. Oh, yes,
it looked like they'd won it, yeah.
Like, I don't think there's even as much contact in this. But what I think swings it for us is the fact that when you look at the replays, Raya decides to come for the ball and Solanke decides to go for Raya. He doesn't go for the ball. He doesn't decide, I'm going to challenge for the ball here. He's not jumping for the ball. He's not jumping to try and get there before David Raya. He looks at Raya and backs into him and deliberately attempts to foul the goalkeeper. Now, I agree, the contact is not much, but the intent is there. I think that's probably what gets us that decision. Like, if Solanke goes up to challenge for that ball, as much as goalkeepers are protected, if it's the same amount of contact in two players going for the same ball, I don't think we get that.
Mm.
But he's not even trying to go for the ball, and I think that is probably what gets us that decision, because I do think, despite the fact there isn't a great deal of contact, there's sufficient contact for Raya not to be able to make the right punch, right? It does impact the way he punches the ball. I think where the more interesting or the more dubious element of this from an Arsenal perspective is whether or not there's a foul by Saliba on Billing.
Well, that's it. Like, I think there probably is. That's what, when I say when you watch it frame by frame, there is kind of a tug in there, isn't there? So what do you do at that point as the VAR? They cancel each other out? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, it's...
But, you know, again, it's a subjective call that could have gone either way. And I take your point about Solanke and Raya, but I sort of think people in houses with posters of Ben White on the wall shouldn't throw stones or something like that.
No, but like, you know, did we not have a goal disallowed by Ben White? You know, a brilliant Trossard goal against Leicester where,
absolutely,
you know, Ben White deliberately impeded the goalkeeper. And if you get away with it, fine. You know, if you can get away with it, I'm all for it. But Bournemouth didn't get away with it in this instance, and we've been punished
goodness,
for it. Yeah,
because it would have made it much nervier than it needed to be.
Sure.
So then actually we even went on to put some gloss on the scoreline.
We sure did. I mean, yeah, that moment would have maybe changed things. This was a game, I think, that should have been more comfortable for Arsenal, but easily could have been a lot more uncomfortable in the final 15 minutes. This was like the 73rd, 74th minute when that happened.
Yeah. I think it's perfectly reasonable to be frustrated about the Saka foul and lack of punishment there. But I also think when you take a step back, probably, you know, we did all right out of the officiating decisions on the day.
Mm.
I think we were the beneficiaries more than we were the victims.
Yes.
Although we were robbed of an absolute wonder goal by Gabriel.
Oh, my God. Yeah, what an unbelievable hit. And it feels, you know, slightly harsh to deny something of that quality because of, what was it? It was Havertz's arm or shoulder or something that was offside?
Yeah, churlish to disallow that. Gabriel was so gutted as well. Like, he sort of celebrated it. And when he saw the referee blow the whistle, he fell to his knees. like, no! Because he knew how good a strike it was.
Oh, my God. I'm just watching it again here. Oof.
Yeah.
Top corner.
Yeah, oh, man.
I know. His face. He'll never score a better one like that. Like, have all the goals he scored for Arsenal have been headers, have they? Is that fair?
He scored one or two with his feet, like in the box, but nothing like that.
Yeah.
Nothing like that.
Unbelievable.
Incredible hit. He'll probably think about that forever. I always think you remember the ones that don't count or that don't go in. You know, like, I feel like it's easier sometimes to remember a time where you hit the bar than a goal you scored, because it's the nearliness of it.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's a shame, but yeah. We did get that third goal in the end. Declan Rice, another rampaging run forward. Gabriel Jesus, substitute, did very well to hold the ball up and play him in. And he did say afterwards, Sidney Rice, I was fuming after that first half miss. And he obviously wanted to get back on the score sheet. Finished very, very well to make it 3-0. And who knows, you know, what that goal could mean in the context of the title race. Any goal is important at this point. Every goal matters. And I think, you know, there is something to be said, or you've got to give credit to a player or the mindset of players in a team where in the 96th minute, and there were like 8 minutes of added time, so we were into the 7th minute of added time, the game was won. Everyone knows it at that point, but Rice was still determined to make a run from deep in his own half to get on the end of it to score a goal. I think there's something hugely admirable about that attitude, you know, because you don't win games late on if you're not prepared to put in those kinds of yards, and doing it in a game like this is just part of how you make that happen.
Yeah, I think it's attitude, but it's also athleticism. I mean, when you watch the replays of that goal, you know, everybody on the pitch is moving at a certain pace, and then he just appears in the screen. Mm. And it feels like, you know, someone's put all his physical stats up to 99 and he's just charging through. I think was it the Wolves game a couple of weeks ago where it got into stoppage time and suddenly he found another gear?
He and Odegaard and Saka, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. The engine that he has, and you know, he's featured in every Premier League game. I think there's one maybe where he started on the bench and came on. Mm. When you pay a lot of money for somebody, that is such an important part of it. Are they going to be available to you? And he has been for pretty much every game, pretty much every minute of every game, right up until the 97th, 98th. Sort of haven't really got enough superlatives for Declan Rice. I mean, in some respects, he's been the difference for Arsenal this season. And like you say, who knows? Is it possible that goal could be the difference come the end of the season?
Well, you never know, and you don't quite know what's going to happen. And we're all crossing our fingers and hoping for miracles and hoping for something to happen that feels a bit unlikely at this point. But all you can do is just win your games and see what happens. And I guess that's going to be the mindset of the players. You know, second last home game they had to win, kept a clean sheet. David Raya, of course, Golden Glove on the back of that clean sheet.
Yeah, I think he was already confirmed to share it, and this means it's his and his alone, which is nice. If you're going to win a Golden Glove, the last thing you want is sort of Jordan Pickford's sweaty hand getting in it with you.
Yeah, you don't want to share with Jordan Pickford. Simple as that.
So, I think it's great. And, you know, he's been a big part of that. But I think, to be honest, that Golden Glove is for the whole team as well, because he's been incredibly well protected this season. We've defended superbly, the entire team out on the pitch. And that's just reward. And, you know, there were some pretty impressive numbers coming out of the game. I mean, obviously there was that 15th clean sheet for David Raya. I think what was it? 88 goals we've matched last season, which was our highest ever goal-scoring Premier League campaign. Number of wins, 26, matches our Premier League record as well, which I think is held by the Invincibles.
Yeah.
You know, we can't ask for much more, Andrew. I mean, they really are doing absolutely everything they can to take this all the way to the wire.
Yes. Where is the other stat that I liked? I think I retweeted it, so let me just go back here. Boom, boom, boom. It comes from at Hente_AFSC on Twitter. Arsenal's current goal difference of plus 60 is the best in the club's history in top flight football after 36 games played in a season.
Yeah. I mean, extraordinary. I mean, you know, I'll be honest and say I didn't think that we had this kind of run necessarily in us. You know, when I thought about last season, so much of it was built on that extraordinary first half of the campaign where we just kept winning. And that felt like this sort of magical thing that being able to reproduce might prove impossible. But the run since Dubai, shall we say, since the turn of the year, has been astonishing.
14 wins, one draw, one defeat.
Yeah. And that draw, by the way, was at the Etihad, one of the hardest places to go in world football. And I think arguably, you know, we played as if a draw was what we were looking for. So we took it.
Yeah, we got what we wanted.
I think it's been an incredible run. And the only thing that sort of makes me more incredulous or is more astonishing is the fact that it might not be enough.
Well, I mean, that's just the reality we face when you're up against a team like Manchester City. And I think, you know, there is, I don't want to get too far into this because I saw a lot of questions about how we should feel if it doesn't happen. And I'm not there yet in my brain, you know. I do have to say, and I said this on the blog yesterday, that whatever happens, I really, really appreciate the fact that we have the team that we've been looking for so long. Because you can't be so entitled, I don't think, as a football fan to say, well, only trophies are good enough. Only winning the league is good enough. You know, that's what we all want. And that's what the players want and the manager wants and the club wants and everybody else. That is what you're there for. That's the job that you're trying to do. But I don't think it's right to say that only that and that alone constitutes something that you can enjoy or experience in a positive way. I said time and time again, I'm sure to you and on the blog, that like all I want from an Arsenal team is a team that looks like it cares, a team that is competitive, a team that can go the distance in the title race. And if we get it over the line, brilliant. And if we don't, you know, it's disappointing and it's frustrating and all the rest. But just sort of step back a little bit and appreciate the fact that these players look like they care. These players play like they care. And they play good football and they win a lot of games and they score a lot of goals and they don't let too many goals in. And I think in another era, this would be a team that's already won the title.
Twice.
Yeah.
Arguably twice.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, this is a champion. This is a champion level team. And, you know, in fairness, I did say earlier in the season, this looks like a team that wins things. It's a team built to win trophies, and it's a team that in any other era would be winning trophies. I think I completely agree with you. It's been an outstanding Premier League campaign, and producing title challenges in back-to-back years is a really impressive level of consistency. I think there'll be a time for kind of, if we don't do it, talking about what that means and maybe why we didn't and what possible tiny room for improvement there might be. But I also think it's very worth sitting back and admiring what has been done this season. Frankly, whatever happens now, you know, almost whatever happens in these final two remaining games, this has been a fantastic period of form since the new year. And when you look at it as a kind of a season, I think we've done extremely well.
Yeah. I mean, we could go into the final day of the Premier League season with the title still up for grabs.
Well, and I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah, we might be dependent on, and probably will be dependent on, you know, an unlikely result happening, you know, in the next couple of weeks for us to win the league. But if we go into the final day and it's still in the balance, albeit slightly shifted towards Manchester City because of, you know, how easy they have it on the final day, hosting West Ham at home, and there's literally zero chance that West Ham are going to get anything from that game. And people can clip this up, and I guarantee it, it's not going to happen. 100%. No way can it happen. There isn't any possibility, even with football being the way it is, that West Ham could pull something out of the bag on that day. Like, I've never been more right about anything.
What would you prefer to? What would you be willing to stake on that, Andrew?
What would I be willing to stake on that? I mean,
obviously your reputation.
My reputation, my life itself.
Your life itself.
My life itself. Yeah. My soul. I'll, you know, my soul. How about
your,
all that?
Your eternal soul.
My eternal soul. Yeah, look, if it is final day madness, you know, I obviously hope we come out the right end of it. But, you know, if you get to that point of a season where it's on the final day, there's not much more you can do. There's always things you can look back on and say, but that's...
You're going to have that in any season.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to take, I hate to break it to everyone, we're not going to take maximum points in any Premier League campaign. It's not going to be 38 times three, I'm afraid. But, you know, we're getting pretty darn close to that these days. Mm. And I just think it would be a tremendous occasion, the final day. I don't take it for granted that we get there. You know, we've got a job to do, Old Trafford. Mm-hmm. But if we can, I was at Highbury in 1999 when that went to the final day. I think that's the last time that's been the case for Arsenal.
That was when Manchester United played Spurs.
Yes, and it looked briefly like Spurs might do us a favour.
Spurs fucking did this.
Of course, they're Spurs. And we played Aston Villa. I think Kanu scored. We won our game, but it wasn't enough. But, you know, if you get to that point, it's going to be a party that last day, right? Because the Invincibles are going to be there. It's going to be a celebration of that achievement as well. It could be an all-timer of a party.
It could be. So, you know, I know there's a lot of, you know, a lot of discussion about what if and what do we do and how do we cope or what do we take. Yeah, I feel, I don't know what you feel, but I would rather have that discussion afterwards or certainly a bit closer to the final day because, I've got to still believe, you know, I've got to still believe that in football there is just the potential for something you don't expect can happen. And look, it could happen to us as easily as it could happen to Manchester City, but I have to believe that we can stay on the right track and that something can happen to them. And if it does, amazing. If it doesn't, you know, I think I'm able to cope, but I don't want to do that just yet.
Fair enough. I agree. Let's stay in the hope. Let's watch and see because it is, you know, it's a wild sport. Crazy things can happen.
Mm-hmm. So, that's that. So 3 points. We were 4 points clear temporarily. It was back to 1 point. And there'll be a lot of focus this week on getting ready for Manchester United. So is there anything else for part one, do you think?
No? Not especially. Good win for the women yesterday, I guess, rounding out the weekend.
Yeah.
Nice to, you know, put some sort of dent in Man City, if not in the men's Premier League title race yet.
Yeah.
But we watch and we wait.
We will wait. All right. Let's take a little break here. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog. Also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. James, do you remember the start of the season?
Oh, it's a long time ago.
It is a long time, but cast your mind back.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're back.
I am going there. I'm going.
Okay. You there?
I'm there. Okay, I'm there. It's August, September time.
Yeah.
And the world feels new and fresh and young.
And we're a little bit worried about what's going on with our
why
football
team. Why is Kai Havertz playing in midfield, Andrew?
Who spent $60 million on Kai Havertz?
No, Jurrien. Jurrien, come back.
But there's something even worse than all of that.
What's happening?
It's that Tottenham are winning games of football under their new manager, Ange Postecoglou.
Oh, no.
Oh, I know. And, oh, my God, we're in October. And, my goodness, they're going so well that they are being compared to the Invincibles. Here's a real headline. Could Spurs outdo the Invincibles? I mean, I don't know how you can fucking outdo being unbeaten. You can't go double unbeaten, you fucking morons. But anyway, Premier League leaders Tottenham on pace to do better than Arsenal's greatest ever team after beating Crystal Palace.
Oh man!
Not dark.
What happened?
Days.
Did they go unbeaten, Andrew? Did they outdo the Invincibles?
Hang on, here comes my fast forward noise. Now we're in the present. We're in the present, James. Look at what's happening. Look,
they get battered everywhere they go.
Everywhere they go. Newcastle 4, Tottenham 0. Tottenham 2, Arsenal 3. Chelsea 2, Tottenham 0. Liverpool 4, Tottenham 2. 4 defeats in a row, and it's fair to say that some of the Tottenham faithful are not happy. So much so, there's a hashtag, James. Can you guess what it is?
I've got a few ideas. Does it begin with Ange?
Yes.
And end with out?
It does.
Terrific.
It does. I like this one from Danny Boyle, not the guy who wrote Trainspotting. He says, fuck you and your persistence of a back four, you stubborn myth. Hashtag Ange out. Hashtag Levy out.
Good to always bring Levy into it.
Of course.
Well. I like this one from KG. He's opened his tweet with hashtag Ange out, hashtag THFC, hashtag Coys. Better to lose the right way? Absolute bollocks. 58 goals conceded, 18 set-piece goals, battered by our rivals West Ham, Arsenal and Chelsea. They won none of those six fixtures, drew one and lost five. Four league wins in 2024, negative goal difference. I'm protesting on the 14th of May and hopefully you are too. Hashtag Ange out. No credentials, no adaptability, no tactics.
A says, out of his depth, naive, pathetic. An amateur at work. Hashtag Ange out. And there's quite a few who really like Richarlison.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, they're Richarlison fans.
Hashtag free Richarlison.
Yeah. One guy says, look at that, you big fat Aussie clown. Put a striker on and you get a goal. Get out the club. Hashtag Ange out. Another guy says, Richie is life. Richie is class. Richie is pure energy. Ange is brain dead. Hashtag Ange out.
I like this guy, HK10 forever. And his Twitter handle is HKane forever. I mean, it must have been a tough year for him. hate this guy with a passion. Really do. Leave my club, you fat cunt. Hashtag Ange out. And what I really like about this tweet is that underneath it, an Arsenal fan called Robert Kellio is doing the Lord's work. He's commented and said, as an Arsenal fan, as much as I want to be a dick, Ange is a great manager. This is his first season and you can see clear signs of progress. He does need to adjust his tactics in certain games, but getting rid would be a mistake. Lovely stuff from Roberto Kellyer.
Well done. Just,
you know, keep peddling that message. Hashtag Anjin.
Well done, that man. They're obviously terrified that this run of bad form could come to an end in the worst possible game. One guy says, if we turn this form around against City, I'm fully hashtag Ange out. In fact, I'll relinquish all support. They're a bit worried about that one.
Well, yeah. I mean, interesting that one I read out said he's protesting on the 14th of May. And I was like, oh, I presume that's the last game of the season. But no of course, it's the Arsenal, the Man City game.
Yes.
Which is their last home game, presumably. I mean, listen, there was a time, as I mentioned in part one, where I thought maybe Spurs could get something there. That time.
No chance.
Has
no
long chance. Since.
No
lost.
Chance. They're going to get hammered.
My eternal soul on it, Andrew.
Both of our souls go on this.
Our souls are on the line.
Just to finish off with this one, I like this from a guy called Tom who said, every week we lose, and all you have to say is that we have to do better. You never do better. You bunch of bottle job cunts. Hashtag Ange out. Hashtag Son out. So little variety.
Son
there.
Catching some flack. Yeah. Don't know, catching a few strays. Oh, I mean, it's been an enjoyable recent run. A few XG chickens coming home to roost.
Mm.
Is that the saying? Do chickens come home to roost?
They do, yes. Chickens come. Yeah. So do pigeons, by the way.
Some sort of bird.
Pigeons do as well, don't they? Racing pigeons. They
pigeons
must.
Pigeons feels
home.
Better to me, but I think it is chickens.
It is chickens.
Oh, toilet ducks. Toilet ducks coming home to roost.
Just before we get into the questions, on the Discord, Bex17 says, I would just like James to rest easy, as I have retorn my ACL to help ensure we win the title. With any luck, I'll be watching the open-top bus parade from my recovery bed. Fair play. Well done to you for inflicting such a horrific injury on yourself for the benefit of all of Goonerdom. We appreciate your sacrifice, and I hope that it does turn out the way that you say in there. So you're hopefully safe, James.
I do appreciate that, especially as in the press room at the weekend, James Benge was sort of spitballing ideas that for me to hurt myself to try and get Arsenal to win the league.
Right. What did he come up with?
Shutting my hand in a door, stepping out in front of a bus.
That's a bit much.
It went quite far with it. So I'm glad I had sort of planned a big stunt for this week. But now I can rest easy.
Well, I mean, I suppose I might as well tell you this now. But the live event that we're doing at Alexander Palace in the theatre, you're coming in like Peter Pan.
Sure.
You know, one of those wires, and we've yet to buy the wire. I'm thinking maybe a roll of kitchen twine would probably do it. That should be fine.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I'm not heavy, so it should be fine. What could go wrong?
What indeed.
So let's see. Let's see what befalls me in the next fortnight as well. Go on then. Shall we have a question?
Yeah, I've got a question here from Master Johnbury.
Okay.
He said, we talk a lot about the stylistic fit of players within a team or a system. Do you think it's even more important that coaches are a good stylistic fit for the team? Why do we not devote as much attention to changes in the coaching staff as you do to changes in the playing squad? And did I see it's been confirmed or it's likely now that Albert Stuyvesant is going to go and take over Feyenoord because Arne Slot?
You're ahead of me there if it's been confirmed. I'd certainly read some reporting about it. Mm. Let's have a look. Stuyvesant. Well, there's certainly tweets saying everyone is going to miss you. He's been linked with the job.
One from M. Arteta 8. Definitely going to miss you there, Albert. Take it easy. Another one from Mr. C. Cuesta. Good luck in your new job. I'm joking, of course. But
I mean, listen, he has been a manager before in Belgium. And I think has aspirations to be the number one again. He was linked with the Ajax job last summer. I don't know if you remember all that, but he was talked about in those terms. So I think that's entirely plausible. that he could, you know, take this opportunity. His stock's very high right now. He's got a great reputation from work he's done with Mikel. And I think it would be a loss. But if there's one thing I know, however, about Mikel Arteta, it's that he'll be very prepared for that eventuality. You know, this is a guy who assembled a kind of hypothetical coaching staff long before he was even a manager.
Mm.
And I'm sure he and Albert have got a very good, close relationship. I'm sure that if he is going to go, there'll have been communication about that. You know, we saw a change in the coaching staff last summer. Steve Round moved on, and Arsenal have maintained their consistency and performance despite that. So I think he'll be very well prepared for such a situation and probably already knows who he'd want if Albert were to go.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting as well because remember when Arsene Wenger was in charge, he had pretty much the same group of coaches all the way through. And there was a little bit of change towards the end, but he kept a core group of people around him. Pat Rice, Boro Primorac, Steve Bould, of course, was there. But one of the things people talked about with Alex Ferguson was, you know, how he brought different assistant managers and people in to give the team a different dynamic at certain times. So whether it plays into that, I did have a really... just a question that occurred to me about Freddie Ljungberg. Why do you think Freddie has sort of eschewed the coaching world since leaving Arsenal? Because, you know, he was an under-15s coach. He had Bukayo Saka first, worked at youth level, went off to Wolfsburg, didn't he, with that guy?
Andreas Jonker.
Andreas Jonker came back to Arsenal, was part of the staff under Unai Emery, spoke a lot about, you know, being in coaching, being in management, left Arsenal saying he wanted to maybe go into management. Why do you think he's not doing something in that regard? Do you think maybe, like in the period where he was working with Arteta and saw, you know, how much is involved to be a manager at a club like that, he kind of went, oh, fuck, that seems like a lot of work. I'll just go on TV instead. It'd be better.
I don't think that's impossible. Do you know what, actually? I'm always hesitant to advise our listeners to watch anything involving Gary Neville, but I'm going to take that risk anyway. The most recent episode of his podcast, I think it's called Stick to Football for the Overlap, he talked about his brief spell as a manager at Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting viewing. Like, he spoke about going into the dugout and came up against one experienced manager. And I think, I forget who it was exactly, but I think he changed formations like three times in the first half. And Neville speaks about being on the touchline and just sort of feeling so out of his depth. And yeah, I think it just illustrates like someone who had been a coach, who had been a pundit, obviously, but also a coach with the England national team, had done all their badges. When you actually take that step into the dugout and go up against people who've been doing this for, in some cases, 20, 30 years, and who are absolutely 100% committed, addicted even, perhaps, to the job and winning, I think it is, you have to be so dedicated to even stand a chance of kind of staying afloat. And I think it probably is a bit of a shock for some people. And maybe the other thing I would say about Freddie, and I honestly don't know why he's not surfaced as a coach anywhere, but maybe he has quite high expectations. You know, he had a fantastic career as a player, as a coach. He's worked with quite high profile clubs, Arsenal and Wolfsburg, held some really good positions at those clubs. You know, maybe he is reticent to do what a lot of managers have to do and go down the pyramid to cut his teeth. Maybe he's difficult for clubs lower down the pyramid to afford. There could be all sorts of reasons, but it does seem like, having been discussed as a really interesting, promising coach, and, you know, indeed he was part of Arteta's staff initially.
Yeah.
it's odd, isn't it, that he's kind of fallen off the radar in that respect.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just a little sidebar there. So,
yeah, I'll be fascinated to see what happens with the coaching staff. I mean, you know, we saw Carlos Cuesta get a promotion of sorts last summer. Would he sort of gain another promotion? To, you know, I know Mikel thinks incredibly highly of him and they have a very good relationship. Would Mikel want someone with some more experience, maybe?
Carlos Cuesta, wasn't he linked with Norwich, was it, as
he
well?
He was, but I think that was quite a spurious link. I don't think there was much to that based on what I've heard. But, you know, sooner or later, he's going to want to be the guy as well. And I think he's a very ambitious person. So I don't think we're talking, you know, 10 years away. I think we're talking sooner than that. And that's the interesting thing, isn't it, as a manager, with your coaching staff, you want people who are good, but part of that is that other people are going to come and take them. I mean, Pep's had to cope with that. You know, he's had a number of assistants.
Like who? I can't think of anyone off the top of my head.
I actually blanked then. I was like, well, Mikel, obviously. Enzo Maresca was at City, wasn't he? He's now with Leicester. I know he's had coaches taken to be other places in the City group. I think he had one go to New York. So he's lost quite a number of staff over the years.
I'd say there's a fucking shelf life of working with Pep, though, as well, where you're like, I can't take this anymore. I need to go plow my own furrow or, you know, just leave the country.
But I do think that this breed of managers at that top level, say Pep or say Mikel, like, there is such an intensity about the way they work. You know, I'm curious to see how their careers play out. Like, can Mikel Arteta really work at this level of intensity for 20 years?
Well, I don't think he can work any other way. I think this is how Mikel Arteta works. I think that's how he worked as a player. I think that's how his mind works. I think maybe the job that he's had to do at Arsenal because of where he came in was maybe a little more complicated, right? You know, it was a complete reset and rebuild job where maybe, I mean, that might be something he faces at another point in his career, but I don't think Arteta can do it any other way. And if he felt like he was doing the job without that intensity, he wouldn't feel like he was doing the job right and would probably just not do it or you know.
I agree with you. I just wonder if that might impact the longevity of this generation of managers. I don't know. There's a lot of talk about Pep potentially calling it a day.
But I mean, do you think the job is more complicated nowadays? Like, are all the things that people have had to grow accustomed to in football, where we talk about the advent of statistical analysis, player analysis, micro analysis of players, the tactical shifts in the game, the increased spotlight, perhaps, where everything exists for much longer than it did. You know, go back 30 years and the game was on Saturday, you talked about it on Sunday, and then you waited until the next game. I'm knocking stuff over in my office again because I'm gesticulating wildly. But yeah, I know that's a simplistic way to look at it, but you know, because of the advent of the internet and online hashtag content, you know, these things live longer in the minds of fans, so it becomes a more complicated job for a manager to deal with all those things. Not to mention, you know, his players are young men who are existing in this world, who are on social media. There are all kinds of things that make the job, I think, more complicated today than it ever has been. Therefore, it demands this level of intensity. Therefore, maybe the burnout rate is a little bit higher. I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps so. I think certainly the scrutiny and the pressure is greater than it's ever been.
Yeah, you lose four games and there's two cunts reading out hashtags about how you should fuck off.
We're part of the problem. We are part of the problem. But I think as well, you're right that the sort of range of responsibilities is so much broader, but there's also probably more delegation than there's ever been. There's probably more staff than there've ever been. It's an interesting one, isn't it? But personally, I am hoping that Pep calls it a day.
Yeah, I wish you'd fuck off. Like now. Go on now.
But ideally, right now, before the remaining games would be good.
That's what I'm saying. Right now, just fuck off and don't come back. I think it's your question.
Okay. Well, we've sort of talked about this a little bit, but Clubby doesn't pull any punches. Clubby goes straight for it. Clubby says, out of Man City's last three games, Fulham away, Spurs away, and West Ham home, which team will give them the most trouble? They're all teams with nothing to play for that'd be happy to see City win the league over Arsenal. So is there any hope?
I mean, do Fulham really care that much one way or the other? I mean, Spurs, obviously, and West Ham, I think are in the vicinity of that. Also because, you know, people can just look at a Man City title win and go, it's just...
Would West Ham want Declan Rice to win the title?
I don't know. Don't think so. Probably not.
Did you see David Moyes' answer yesterday, by the way, about Declan Rice?
About why his team have conceded so many goals.
And he just said Declan Rice. Yeah. And I sort of thought, based on what I've seen of Declan Rice, that's probably, there's a lot of truth to that, I suspect.
That makes a lot of sense. I don't know. I've said this on the blog. I've maybe said it on the podcast. I have a sneaky feeling about the Fulham game. I don't know why. Don't know what it is. I just have a feeling. I mean, it would be the Spursiest thing of all time for Spurs to be absolutely shit. Like, so shit for game after game after game. They could lose. When did they play another game before they play Man City?
Let's have a look.
Let's have a quick look.
Yes, they host Burnley.
Right, so it would be quite Spursy to lose to Burnley and then somehow beat Manchester City. That would be, if you were thinking about the Spursiest thing that Spurs could do right now, like win a game they do not want to win a game they have no right to win based on their form, it would be the Spursiest thing of all time if it handed Arsenal the title.
And maybe the funniest thing ever.
Oh, undoubtedly. But I like I said, I think the odds of that are very, very low. My hope is on the Fulham game. That may be away from home. Fulham put in a decent performance, which they can do on their day, as we have experienced. Unfortunately, this season, that's the one that I'm looking for as the moment where if they drop points, I think it's going to be there. That's where I have my little bit of hope. If they don't do it, I pretty much have no hope. Like, I'll keep everything crossed, but I wouldn't expect anything after that, so.
Yeah, my hope's with Fulham because that's the next one.
Yeah.
And after that, it will transfer to Tottenham, and then after that, to West Ham.
Transferable hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm just pushing it on, rolling it over to the next game. So that Fulham game's on Saturday lunchtime. So before, the day before our game at Old Trafford. So, you know, we will kind of know. I mean, what a boost it would give if Fulham could get a result in that game.
Saturday lunchtime, I will be not in front of a television. I will not be watching that game. And I'm expecting my phone to go zzz, 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 with people going, oh, my God, Fulham. So, you know, make that happen. I'm just saying it out loud into the universe so it actually happens.
Okay, that would be lovely.
What about this one? We just mentioned him. Carrie on the Discord says, are we reaching the point where we need to think about the possibility of Declan Rice being our left eight, given how incredible he can be there? Or does his price tag necessitate him being a six long term? Also, have we seen the best of him as a lone six so far?
I think this is a really interesting question because he's performed so well. I think 7 goals and 8 assists now in the Premier League for Declan Rice. Mm. And he just does have this tremendous physical capacity to make runs into the box. And he's not a bad finisher when he gets there.
No. You know,
he's got good ball striking technique. So he's got that aspect of his game. You know, I don't think he's quite a Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard type in terms of being able to contribute, you know, 15 to 20 goals a season. But he's got the potential to offer something.
Mm.
I think I sort of asked Arteta about this a bit in his press conference, and he sort of gave quite a standard answer about, well, you know, it's a game by game thing. It depends on the opposition. It depends on who else is available. It depends on who you're playing against.
Mm.
I think that there's some merit in that. I think that's probably true. In which case, I think the important thing is surrounding Declan Rice with other midfield players who have a similar degree of flexibility. So then you have true options in terms of how you deploy these guys. You know, I don't think you necessarily have to decide he is a number six or he is a number eight, but you need to make sure you've got a squad that enables you to kind of use him as either, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's fascinating that he's still, when he's asked, like, where do you think your best position is? And he will say number six.
He says it unequivocally. Yeah,
without question. But I think probably his best performances for Arsenal have been when he's played a little higher up the pitch, where he has the space and the freedom to stretch those legs and like we touched on in the first half, you know, show how important that engine is and what it can do to the team.
I suppose my thing would be like, is it, you know, would that question be solved if we really had a number eight who was a more natural attacking player? You know, like if we had a guy who was like a sort of Odegaard type in terms of productivity, creativity, you know, skill, imagination in the final third, would that end the debate? Because you'd be like, well, Rice is going to play behind those two guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really interesting aspect of it. And that's why I was always just a little bit, when it came to Havertz in midfield, I was hopeful, but I was just maybe a little, I wondered if Arteta might go for a right-footed player there, because we've two left-footed players in Saka and Odegaard over on the other side of the pitch, and I know he was replacing Granit Xhaka, but I did wonder in terms of balance if a right-footed player in that left eight position might be quite effective, because we would then have two right-footed players, you know, whether it's Trossard or Martinelli on the left-hand side, and then somebody else you know, in there, which is where we've seen Declan Rice and seen him play really well. I mean, the other aspect of this is you could say maybe the decision is made if you bring in a number six who's only a number six, who's really good at that job.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
True.
I mean? So
yeah,
then
yeah.
your decision is made because, well, are we going to play Rice there? Well, no, we'll play this guy because that's what he does. This is the kind of player he is. And, you know, I've seen links to Bruno Guimaraes and Martin Zubimendi and players like that who would be perhaps much more six than eight, whereas Rice is six but also eight. You know, he's both of those things and can be both of those things. Whereas if your decision is made because of, I don't want to say the limitations of a player, but the skill set of a player in that sixth position, it might well then make your mind up about Rice.
Yeah, I think Arsene Wenger used to use this terminology when talking about players sometimes. He would say there is a force coming out of him. Like when a player found a groove, a form, or was thriving in a new position, he would say, like, there is a force coming out of him. And I do feel a bit like that about Declan Rice at number eight, that there is this kind of force there that if we can find a way to harness, we might unlock a new dimension to him. Like, I really think he has the potential to do it and be very, very good there. Has been very, very good there for Arsenal already. I also think that maybe these decisions aren't going to be made in isolation. Like, it's not just about Declan Rice. It's probably about the entire composition of Arsenal's left-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And when Arteta and Edu, you know, are looking at the summer and their plans, it might depend on the kind of left-back they want in the team, you know, whether that's a guy who's going out on the overlap or stepping into midfield. That will affect the sort of midfielder they want in advance of that. It might be influenced by the kind of winger that we have on the left-hand side. Is it Leandro Trossard? Is it Gabriel Martinelli? Is it somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
I think those decisions are also going to be big factors in what we decide to do with that side of the midfield. It's all about the relationships, right? But it is fascinating, and I guess it's a great sort of luxury and a great debate to have.
Mm-hmm.
To have a player like Rice who really can do both jobs. And it is interesting, like you say. I mean, Zubimendi very much number six. You know, we hear that Arsenal, that's how they see Bruno as well, very much a number six. So, you know, if one of those players was to come in, you'd have to think we'd see more and more of Rice at number eight.
Time will tell. Time will tell.
He's not bad in either position.
No.
Well, let's have the. I like this, the optimism of this question. Eddie Longbridge, who will be the player who scores the winning goal that clinches the title for us on the last day of the season, earning himself legendary status and marking himself down in Premier League history with a goal that lives on forever and echoes through the ages?
Cedric. No,
I like Sid actually replied. Colin Sid said it's got to be former Gunner Mavropanos for West Ham.
Oh, there you go. Actually, yeah, or Lukas Fabianski.
Sure,
up for a corner in the dying seconds of the game, and he thumps home a header to help his former club win the title. I guess the question's more about which Arsenal player might do it.
Have you got a sneaky feeling for anybody?
Ooh. I mean, there's so many. That's the thing about this team. There's so many people who can score goals and so many people who do score goals. I will say William Saliba with a header. How about that? But I hope, you know, whatever happens against Everton, yeah, it's not 1-0. It's only a one goal game. I hope we're a little more comprehensive on the final day. But as we have been
over the last couple of seasons.
Yeah.
Jordan Pickford hasn't got a golden glove to fight for anymore. Do you know what I mean? So
he's on the beach. He's on the beach.
I don't know who it will be. You know, Bukayo Saka has been burdened with glorious purpose and has that sense of destiny about him.
I mean, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I think build the statue now if that happens. But I'm going to actually say Trossard. I just think he keeps coming up with moments. And sometimes in a title win, in the sort of, you know, my distant memory of them anyway, you get players who kind of aren't necessarily automatic starters who can provide these defining moments, you know, and it makes them a cult hero forever. And I just have a sneaky feeling that he might have one more in him.
Okay.
But let's see. I hope it comes to that.
Yeah, me too. We'll keep fingers crossed. Desi_Arse on the Discord says, this question is for James. I want to preface this by saying that this is not a dig. How difficult is it to report on Arsenal as an Arsenal fan? The story about Gabriel Jesus last week wasn't a particularly positive one for the club, especially at this stage of the season. So on the one hand, as a fan, I imagine you don't want to see that. But on the other hand, it's your job and it's a big story to break. What's your thought process when something like that comes up?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, in fact, someone asked me about this on the Discord and I did reply there. So I'll probably just say the same thing, which is that the way it works is that at The Athletic, we have a meeting every Monday where we sort of chat about what's happened over the weekend and we share, you know, information or stuff we've been working on. And in one of those meetings a few weeks ago, I happened to mention that I'd heard that Gabriel Jesus were prepared to listen to offers for Gabriel Jesus. I should get the wording of that right.
Yeah.
And that was sort of seen as something, oh, that's quite interesting. And then basically in the wake of the Spurs game, where I think he was on the bench and didn't get on, and Kai Havertz had another good game, scored a good goal.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a few weeks on. They were like, would you be happy to write it this week? And it's my job. And I did, because I think Jesus and his future and what's going to happen with him is a worthwhile topic of discussion at this point in time. And yeah, I there was a bit of pushback from people who said, oh, they didn't think that was helpful. But ultimately, I was just kind of doing my job. I actually don't sort of, how can I put it? I don't value the weight of my words so highly that I think they could have any realistic impact on Arsenal's performance.
Sure.
You know, and I know that Gabriel Jesus is an incredibly focused professional person, and I think the only, and this is a very slim possibility, but the only upshot that a story like that would have produced from him would be an upturn in performances. And in fact, he came on at the weekend and created
got an assist.
Goal, so.
Yeah,
I'm claiming the assist.
The assist for the assist.
Assist
pre-assist.
Yeah. No, but it is a constant dilemma as a fan, you know, when the timing of stories happens. And all I can say is that I try with everything I do to be very transparent with the club about what I'm going to write and have an open dialogue with them about it. They would have been totally aware what I was going to write and, you know, given a right of reply and things like that. So, that's it.
I think the way things like this play out, you know, unfortunately for you and for many journalists and writers, is that they will report one thing, but it gathers traction as kind of something else.
Well, that's
true. You know what I mean?
And I would say that's happened a little bit here.
Yeah, because what you're reporting was at Arsenal, and I have to hold my hands up and say that that was something I had heard as well, that Arsenal, you know, had some doubts over the future of Gabriel Jesus, right? Mm. And what your report was, it was like Arsenal are, you know, would listen to offers, maybe listen to the right offer for Gabriel Jesus this summer. It's not the same as Arsenal are trying to sell Gabriel Jesus. Arsenal want to get rid of Gabriel Jesus. Gabriel Jesus is stupid and bad. We don't like him anymore. But when these things, you know, are broken down into 140 or 280 character snippets and people react to them in that way and they get repurposed and rewritten, you know, it comes across as something that isn't what you wrote.
No,
you know?
And that's unfortunately, I knew that was going to happen, you know, because that's the nature of sort of social media and aggregators. But, you know, it's what happens. And also, you know, if we take Mikel Arteta at his word, it's all nonsense anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, that's the case of a manager saying absolutely the right thing. You know, he's got a player that he needs to keep focused on at that point in time, three remaining games. Time will tell with Jesus. My mm-hmm. personal opinion, I'd kind of like to see him stay. If we can get him fitter,
yeah,
more available, I think he's a brilliant player. And I'm sure Mikel Arteta thinks that as well, because yeah, he's spoken so many times about his admiration for him. I just suspect that, you know, maybe within the club, they look at the allocation of resource to him and think, are we getting maximum value for that right now?
Mm.
Because he's not cheap, you know, he's not on a low salary. It's an interesting one. And if I'm completely honest with you, I'm a little bit dubious as to who would buy Jesus right now with some of the concerns over his knee.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know. You never know. Yeah. And I think if an offer did arrive, the club would certainly listen to it.
Maybe he'll be the one to get the goal that wins us the title.
Maybe so. I mean, who would put it past him? You know, I really think a fit and firing Gabriel Jesus is very possibly in our best 11 footballers. You know, it's just something we've not seen as much as we would have liked of this season.
That's true.
And like you wrote in your blog the other day, I have the sense, have the feeling that availability is something that Mikel Arteta really prizes.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bit of frustration when, you know, players aren't able to contribute as regularly as he would like.
Yes.
What else have we got here? A few questions about Thomas Partey. Johnny Bow said, "Goodly morning, gents. The last three games we've seen Partey back in the side and getting back to his best, with Jorginho seemingly staying. Do you feel Mikel will look to keep both players? There's noise it's one or the other, but would Arteta play him in such a vital end sprint if he didn't see a long-term place for him?"
I think there is in football terms, a pragmatism, a short-termism when it comes to what you do. which doesn't always mean that there are any long-term implications you can take from it. Like, if he thinks Partey is the best player to get us over the line in a title race, he will use Thomas Partey.
I think there's an element as well, this isn't to diminish Thomas Partey's performances in recent weeks, but I think there is an element right now of Mikel just sticking with a winning formula as well.
Yes.
You know, when you're in the very heat of a run-in, this is something Alex Ferguson did and Arsene Wenger used to do it as well. You've got a team that's winning. You've got momentum. I think he sees a value in just like, let's keep doing that.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting one, Partey, because, you know, Arteta was pretty unequivocal about Jorginho in his press conference, wasn't he? They want him to stay. They're doing what they can to get him to stay. I mean, Partey does have a contract for another year.
But if you buy, if you go out and get that six.
Yeah. If you spend 100 million on Bruno, for example.
Yeah. Should we do that?
I don't know. Should. That would certainly test Arsenal's fans' forgiveness, wouldn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think that's...
It might test Jorginho's, to be honest.
Yeah, it's too much money. I know that's the release clause. I think he's a good player. And we've got our issues with him, but, you know...
That is a lot of money. I think, you know, Declan Rice money, there were sort of reasons around Declan Rice. I think his nationality, I think, you know, the fact that he didn't have any sort of clause, I think City's interest, those things all pushed the price to that height. I would be cautious about paying that much for Bruno, although it does feel like Chelsea have unfortunately distorted the market to the extent that a top Premier League central midfield player probably now costs £100 million. Yeah, I guess if they buy a six, maybe Partey moves on. I mean, I spoke about resource again. Partey's not a low earner, is he?
No, not at all. Not at all. If you get some millions and 200 and something thousand pounds a week off the wage bill, you know, that might be the pragmatic thing to do in the summer. If the pragmatic thing right now is to play him, I have to say, you know, there is a lot to his game on his day that's good. I worry a little bit about how... I could be completely wrong here. I think you've got two London derbies. You've also got a home game against Bournemouth where we dominated the first half. We played really well against Chelsea in the second half. I'm just a little cautious about the dynamic that he brings to the team at times. And I'm not saying it's entirely him. It could be external factors as well. I do wonder if, you know, as Arteta moves towards a system or a team that is ever more control-focused, the sort of slightly chaotic elements that Partey can be involved in at times might be something he'd be willing to part ways with if he can get a more secure six in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fascinated by the Bruno thing because, again, for me, he's a player who has a kind of combustibility about him, partly in terms of temperament, as we've seen. And I find that a slightly surprising selection if that's ultimately what the club do. But they have earned our trust by this point. They really have with the signings they've made and how they've played out for the most part.
Do you think, when you talk about that player or the players that are coming in, that they probably do need to be around that age bracket?
Yeah, I mean, how old is Bruno?
26.
Yeah, probably. It wouldn't surprise me if we got some younger players for kind of the second layer of the squad or maybe even older players for the second layer of the squad. I think we might need a bit more, you know, if we sell people like Nelson, Smith Rowe, Eddie, we might need players who provide depth in some way. But if we're expecting players to come into this team now and make a difference in August, they probably need to be pretty close to their peak, I think.
Yeah.
The Partey thing is really interesting. Yeah. Listen, whenever Thomas Partey is fit, there's a temptation to think he could be the guy. And then you remember that he misses half your matches. And I think if we can get someone who's going to take that chunk of salary and be more available, I think that's probably the right call at this point in time.
Is it my question or your question?
It's yours, actually.
It's mine. How far in are we, actually? Oh, God, we're a long way in.
We're
a long way in. I think we should leave it there.
Yeah, because I've got other questions, but they're all about like contextualizing the season and what if we don't win. And I think you're right. Let's part that for today.
Yeah. Okay, look, we better leave it there. Get this podcast out to everybody. Let them relax into the week and hope that all the good things happen from an Arsenal perspective. All the bad things happen to Manchester City as ever. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for downloading and listening. And we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.